Hello, and welcome to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks, a series of talks by scholars and graduate students on all aspects of film, television, and screen-based media. If you'd like to join our network or find out more about us, you can follow us on Twitter at @SSSnetwork and like us on Facebook at Sydney Screen Studies. You can also visit our website at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.
Today, we have Dr. Karina Aviad, am I saying that correctly? Great. Who is from the University of Sydney. She's a postdoctoral research fellow in the Department of Media and Communications. She's the author of The Lure of the Big Screen, Cinema in Rural Australia and the United Kingdom, and has published on cinema and film in Media International Australia, Studies in Australasian Cinema, Participations and Continuum. Karina is also the co-editor of the collected volumes Watching Films, New Perspectives on Moviegoing, Exhibition and Reception, and New Patterns in Global Television Format. So, incredible kind of resume there. Karina is going to talk today on phenomenology and contemporary film consumption, and her respondent after the talk will be Adam, as I said. And so we'll just sort of do a casual Q&A, led by Adam, I suppose. And if you have any sort of questions, if you could save it till then. But please join me in making Karina welcome.
Thank you for your lovely introduction. So thank you for having me to speak today. I'm really excited to be here and really excited to have only recently discovered the Screen Studies Network. So I think it's terrific. There's, you know, only quite a limited, I guess, opportunities for people who are doing screen studies in Australia. So this is great, I think. So as Phoebe said, I'm a postdoctoral research fellow at the University of Sydney, and I'm working on my own project, which is about contemporary film consumption practices. And in particular, I'm trying to think about expanding the ways in which we might conceptualise and understand the practice of viewing films. And one of, I think, the key challenges for thinking about the ways in which people consume films in the present day is the vast sort of multiplicity of the way in which that happens. So once upon a time, that was very neatly defined and contained by the physical space of a cinema theatre, and then I guess a little bit later by the living room, by the hardware of a VHS machine and DVD and so on. But now audiences obviously can watch films on a very wide range of devices and in a variety of physical places. They're not limited to these sort of traditional outlets for film. The multifunctionality and the internet connectivity of most of the contemporary media devices that we use adds sort of another layer, I guess, of complication, and it means that film is now sort of intermeshed in everyday media practices in ways that it wasn't before. And so in terms of research, I think this presents a number of challenges. From a methodological perspective, academic research on film audiences has tended to be fixed either in sort of geographical and chronological sort of frameworks. So very used to seeing audience research that might be looking at audiences of a particular cinema, audiences for particular genres of films, even, you know, as narrow as audiences of a specific film. And organising research in this way becomes trickier when we know that audiences are accessing and watching films in a very wide variety of ways, and that the process of switching between these different modes of viewing is highly flexible and it's not linear. And so contemporary viewing is, I think, increasingly difficult to contain within the structures of time and space. If you think about being a keen cinema goer, for example, doesn't preclude you from also being a frequent watcher of films on DVDs at home or streaming pirated movies on your laptop, you know, all that sort of thing. A person can move frequently, fluidly between these, making the task of situating film viewing more complex. I'm certainly not suggesting that time and place are no longer important. I think they're really fundamental aspects of understanding film consumption. But for me, in order trying to sort of capture a sense of overall pictures of behaviours and motivations of audiences, I think it's sort of time to try a new approach to viewing and to sort of think about it from some different angles, to try and think about perspectives that might help us better understand the complexity of modern film consumption and the ways in which it sort of overlaps and interconnects. A lot of the research that Phoebe mentioned that I've published to date is to do with rural cinema and to do with audiences at rural cinemas. And it's research that's probably most squarely situated within a field known as new cinema history. Does that mean anything to... I know it should mean to Zoe, but tell us. Okay, so... So this is a sort of a field, I guess, that's pioneered by, among others, Richard Maltby, Daniel Bilteris, Philippe Mears, Kate Bowles, and a few others. And so new cinema history broke away from traditional film history by stepping away from an emphasis on the film. So instead of trying to plot a historical narrative according to films, it was looking at the broader sort of social, cultural and industrial factors that shaped the opportunities people had to watch films, their aspirations, their habits and their experiences and so on. Now, that has been hugely influential, I think, in the study of audiences and film audience studies, while I think sits alongside that, you know, there is a great deal of overlap. And I think, you know, the key thing is highlighting that moviegoing is not just about an encounter with a text. There's a whole lot more goes on, you know, in that experience. And so, you know, and it's been a big influence on still on the way I think about things and my research. So in trying to think about that as, I guess, my foundation and thinking of how to move on from there, I think that for trying to come to terms with the multiple forms of modern film viewing, we need to expand the interest that new cinema history has kind of introduced us to more explicitly consider the influences and effects of other media on movie watching practices. And in this way, I think it's possible to understand more about the nature of different options that audiences have, what makes them opt for one experience over another, what do audiences expect or seek out from the different modes of viewing that they select. So as a means of kind of illustrating the potential of this slightly different approach, my presentation today focuses on screens and some work that I've been doing recently on the sort of phenomenological or embodied relationship between viewers and the different screens that they use. So, as many of you probably know, phenomenology has its roots in philosophy and it's considered variously as a theory and as a methodology. One of the things that initially attracted me to phenomenology was the emphasis on the body, on something that's physically experienced. And so for me, not being a high theorist, this was something that felt tangible, felt real, if you like. And it sort of represented, I guess, a contrast to some of the other approaches in film theory, which I find perhaps a little bit more abstract and which I've struggled to apply in ways that sort of feel relevant and satisfactory and so on. However, what I discovered, the more research I did on phenomenology, was that it was no more straightforward than a lot of these other theories I struggled with, and I sort of almost abandoned it altogether. But anyway, I kept on going, and, you know, I think I came out the other end with some things I think that are interesting. Phenomenology is not a new concept in film studies. Some of you will be familiar with Vivian Sobchak's book, The Address of the Eye, and Jennifer Baker's The Tactile Eye. Both of them are concerned with physical elements of watching films and sort of arguing that far from being passive, the eye in particular is engaged in a very concrete and physical way in film viewing. Taking a slightly different approach, Kate Insey published a journal article in 2011 that tries to connect up the approaches of phenomenology and psychoanalysis to sort of further the understanding of identification of film characters. Phenomenology has tended to be used largely in relation to film studies in order to understand how audiences interpret text. That's kind of how it's been predominantly used. And it also tends to be, perhaps not surprisingly, associated with highbrow type of cinema. It's not a concept that's applied to sort of Hollywood films and so on. And so, to give you an example, Kate Insey's article suggests that visual texts have a lot of power, and in particular, the power to re-educate our look, our sort of view of the world, how we see things and so on. But she does qualify that by saying that it applies to more exploratory images usually associated with independent and gallery exhibited films, not the heavily formulaic codes of entertainment cinema. So that automatically, you know, gets me all worked up, because I don't know why independent and gallery films can't be entertainment, or why an entertainment film couldn't challenge you to think differently about the world, however. So, but that's kind of just to give you a flavour, I guess, of how phenomenology's been applied. More recently, phenomenology is a concept that's been used by mobile media scholars. Ingrid Richardson is one of them, and they've used it as a framework for trying to understand the nature of our relationship with small portable screens, mostly. And it was sort of discovering that strand of work that really helped me, I guess, to progress something within my research. So just before I go on to talking about screens and film, it is appropriate just to mention very briefly some fundamental points of division that exist among phenomenologists about the nature of phenomena. So Edmund Husserl is probably considered the father of phenomenology. He wrote in the early 20th century about phenomenology as a philosophical approach, and he also suggested it could be a research method. And he says phenomenology begins with a commitment to the openness of its object of inquiry rather than to any prior certainty of what that object really is. So with an open mind. However, he believed that phenomena possessed an essential essence or meaning, so that if you could strip away all the cultural preconditioning and all the cultural knowledge that you had, that it would be possible to discover the true meaning of various phenomena. A lot of scholars who've come after Husserl have had problems with the kind of ahistorical and acultural nature of his idea, and sort of part of the criticism is that it was pushing phenomenology too far towards metaphysics. However, it is important to emphasise that Husserl's ideas have by no means been completely discredited or disused. An article published in 2011 in the British Journal of Education Technology about the phenomenology of on-screen reading of course materials by university students clearly draws on this kind of idea of Husserl's. And this is especially clear in the methodology section, where the author Ellen Rose discusses her desire to capture the pre-reflective experiences of the students who participated in her interviews. So the implication there is that there was kind of a truth, or at least a more authentic version of their experiences that could be captured if the students didn't think too far ahead about their responses or presupposed, you know, too much what was expected of them in the study. So the idea is, well, she wanted to study them in their natural state. You know, the idea, inevitably when you tell someone they're going to participate in a study, they will, you know, make adjustments and start to anticipate what you're going to ask them and so on. So his, those kind of ideas are still alive and well, and then by no means, completely discredited. But one of the key scholars and probably one of the most influential people in phenomenology is Maurice Merleau-Ponty, who wrote about phenomenology in the 50s. And he argued that instead of seeking this essential truth that Husserl talked about, that phenomenologists seek to disclose in any given case both the general and particular structures, meanings, and ambiguities of a phenomena as they are perceived and lived in context. So many scholars who apply phenomenology, including in a basic way myself, tend to follow this kind of approach, that phenomenology cannot be just about thinking of the conditions of being in the world, but you need to be attuned to the conditions of being in a particular world. So that means attending to the contents of embodied experience, so the what that appears to you, the form, how it appears to you, and the context, so why it appears in the way that it does. And I don't think culture, society, and history cannot entirely be put to one side in order to understand conscious and embodied experience, is my view. So with that in mind, we'll go back to some cinema screens. So in terms of thinking about phenomenology, I began with thinking about cinema screens, and, you know, arguably they are no longer the place where most films are seen. But I think they represented a useful place to start sort of rethinking things, partly because of their cultural significance. They're still regarded as the authentic or preferred place for watching films, and that's still a very culturally dominant idea. And cinema screens are quite different to most of the other screens that we use, and that thinking about those contrasts was actually extremely useful. So screens have pretty much permeated every aspect of modern life. Screens are not only part of media devices and computers and so on, but we use screens at banks, ATMs, order food at McDonald's, the supermarket checkout. You know, we're very, very used to seeing screens. They've become central to our way of inhabiting and shaping the world that we live in. They are objects, to use Merleau-Ponty's phrase, they are already presumed relevant by us. So we know screens provide us with information or entertainment, or they enable us to fulfil a function. We understand that screens are significant and necessary in everyday life. So kind of like a really basic example would be turning it up in an airport to catch a flight, and the first thing you do is you look to the screen because you know that it's going to give you information. So we're culturally attuned, you know, to kind of to doing that. Modern screens can be sort of highly varied in terms of their design, their size, their purpose, and so on. But I think there's four key similarities that link them, and are useful for thinking then again about cinema screens. So first of all, most of the screens that we use in daily life are encountered quite close to our face. So mobiles, tablets, touch screens, this iPad in front of me, Google Glasses, all those things are close relatively to your face. They very often involve the use of fingers or some other part of your external body in order to make them work. And in that quite broad sweep, I included television because the remote control provides a sort of similar kind of functionality, I suppose, to a touch screen, although the screen when you're watching television is generally, you know, a little bit further away. I know that may seem a little bit tangential, but I am further encouraged in making that claim by Peter Greenaway, who you may all know, asserted that the death of cinema occurred not when films moved out of cinemas and into homes, but when the remote control, he calls it a remote control zapper, was introduced into the living room. So for him, the crucial difference was audiences were then able to stop fast-forward control. They didn't have to watch the film being presented to them in the way the director had intended. I think the third area or third characteristic of contemporary screens that's significant is that very often they're connected to the internet and sort of other telecommunications networks, and that this provides real-time information and communications. It provides, has an interface that is immediate, dynamic, and externally linked. And the fourth characteristic, which isn't applicable to all screens, but is arguably applicable to the majority of the time that we spend on screens, is that the devices are capable of and are very regularly used to perform multiple functions. So your phone, iPad, whatever. So interestingly, and you probably already got there yourselves, cinema screens don't exhibit any of those features. They are generally encountered a significant distance from your face. You don't activate your external body in terms of controlling what appears on the screen. You know, the internet might be used in cinemas to deliver the film to the screen, but there's no audience interactivity. And cinema screens are not multi-purpose. They're linear, they're predictable. They narrow rather than multiply our field of vision and experience. They section off the periphery by dimming the lights. They follow a well-established pattern of audiovisual presentation. You know exactly what's going to happen when you go to the film. You're going to get ads, trailers, the film, and then that's it. They also promote an etiquette that discourages audiences from engaging with other media devices. So you might be shunned if you're using your phone in the cinema. You also might be told to shut up if you're talking. So, you know, that's all quite significant differences. And I think they raise some interesting questions about what kinds of experiences a present-day cinema outing offers and delivers to audiences. So what does a cinema sell to us when they want to get us in the door? And what do we sign up for? What do we expect when we go? So returning then to the phenomenological aspect, Ingrid Richardson, who I mentioned earlier, who does the work on mobile screens, has written a little bit about cinema as a sort of an example to illustrate her points on mobile screens largely. And she suggests that contemporary cinema produces a condition of being within rather than in front of, which is, she suggests, is the case with most other screens. And she... She suggests that in the optimum situation, the boundary or interface between the body and cinematic apparatus dissolves, a merger which manifests a change in orientation from being in front of to being within, an effect which is achieved by several factors: the size of the screen, the darkness of the theatre, and not the least by surround sound. Now, to her list of conditions, I would add a lack of interactivity and a lack of engagement and mobility of the external body as further relevant factors to thinking about creating these conditions of within. Now, Richardson doesn't explicitly discuss the phenomenological dimension of absorption, but I think that's certainly implied in this concept she has of being within. I certainly wouldn't suggest that this condition of within or absorption is only possible in a cinematic context, and I'm not sure that that's what Richardson would suggest either. But I think it's a very interesting point to start further thinking. For a lot of you, students of film scholarship, these ideas of Richardson would have a very familiar ring. You know, there's many people who've made arguments in favour of the desirability or the superiority of the cinema theatre, and in seeing films in those locations. John Ellis, for example, in the 90s, made very large part of his argument about the distinction between film and television rested on the conditions, the physical conditions of the cinema. So while his assertions and of many others haven't typically been based in a sort of phenomenological analysis, the sort of end position or the arguments end up being very similar, that the physical conditions of the cinema produce a viewing experience that is focused, emotionally engaging, and as such, it constitutes the proper or authentic place to watch films. In contrast, domestic forms of viewing are very often positioned as less aesthetically correct, less rewarding, less culturally valuable. They are seen probably as producing the type of being in front of experience that Richardson identifies in opposition to this idea of the more intense experience of being within. Now, as I've already sort of flagged, I have a great deal of difficulty with debates and kind of analysis that brings into play high and low cultural assumptions and that where those, I guess, are central to the arguments that are being made. So I think that this is an area where I think some caution is needed, and for me, a great deal of precision is called for in terms of thinking about my own phenomenological observations, because I've certainly been suggesting to you that the space of the cinema, in contrast to the way other modern screens we experience, do create a more focused and intense, or can create a more focused and intense experience. So I guess I should say that I think cinemas are terrific, and they're certainly the place where I prefer to see films, but it, in practical terms, is the place where I hardly ever see films, unfortunately. So that's, I guess, a personal preference. But again, I think you being aware of that and setting that to one side is important. I think assertions about the superiority of the cinema and of the films that are shown in it, often rest around claims for film as an art form over other types of audiovisual content. I think this is, you know, very heavily culturally conditioned and quite deliberately historically constructed. So I think, you know, that is highly problematic. I also have issues with assumptions that are very often made about behaviours, presumed sort of seriousness and attentiveness of a cinema audience versus the distraction of TV viewers and audiences elsewhere. Now, while I disagree with making assumptions, I think regarding the second point, it is something, you know, I need to take very seriously in my research. I've already flagged up this question that, you know, that the ways in which we use media, we watch films and across different devices and different times and places is very fluid. So this idea of distraction, multitasking and so on, shifting between different devices and apps, and, you know, is something, you know, that does need serious consideration. At the same time, we need to remember that there is plenty of historical evidence about cinema audiences being loud, talking, being unfocused, and so on, at cinemas. So being at a cinema doesn't mean you are focused and dedicated. Conversely, there's some studies, one done in the US and one done in the UK, just small audience ethnographic studies about watching films at home. And those demonstrate that that can be an intense and singular, attentive experience. So while we can't presume a particular place of consumption or a type of screen and film will necessarily deliver a singular type of film experience, or that particular type of experience can only be found or had in one particular type of place. So that the intense experience of watching a film can not only occur just in a cinema. Sorry, I've lost my place. So while I've suggested that the cinema and the screen and the other phenomenological components of that can create the opportunity for a sort of a heightened experience, it's up to the individual viewer whether they take that up or engage with that or not. So you can go to the cinema, you can talk, you can text, you can not watch the film properly because you're frightened or you're bored, you know, and you probably not had a particularly rich or focused experience. Conversely, at home, you might watch a film with a really dedicated and uninterrupted focus. You might even do that on a laptop. And I'm sure we've all had experiences of doing that. I've had experiences of watching a film on a plane and ending up crying. You know, there's not really very much privacy on a plane, but, you know, you're so engaged with what you're watching, you know. And it's interesting that this type of viewing, so that if you're watching a film at home, maybe television, laptop and so on, is very often connected with other practices that seek to recreate the conditions of a cinema theatre. So if you're watching at home with a friend or partner or something, you're sitting down to watch a film, you might dim the lights. You might get snacks together and set them all out before the movie starts. You might not talk. You might put your phone away and concentrate, give dedicated attention to the film. Very often, you might also choose the largest screen available in the house to, well, assuming it's in the house, but the largest screen available to you to watch the film. So there's an important change to the way the screen is used in those instances. So, for example, watching a film on a television screen in the kind of conditions I've just described, the television screen becomes as static as a cinema screen. You're not channel surfing, there's no interruptions, and you've got, you know, around you everything narrowing your vision and so on and directing your attention towards the screen. So in sort of coming, I guess, full circle around back to Merleau-Ponty, this to me underscores the absolute importance of considering context alongside the form and the contents of the embodied experience. Herzl's idea that phenomena possess a kind of essential essence or characteristics is, for me, just not able to match or work alongside the flexibility and multiplicity of contemporary film viewing. There's still a lot of more work for me to do in terms of testing and developing these ideas, and ideally I would love to get the chance to do this through a large audience research project. So I submitted a DECRA application to the ARC last week, which is hoping to do exactly that. Whether that will be successful or not, I have no idea. But I am really encouraged by the new pathways for understanding the film experience that are opened up by employing a sort of phenomenological-based analysis. And in particular, that the idea that the study of phenomenology of screens leads into understanding more about a second area of phenomenology, which is absorption, and something that's, you know, really been at the core of a lot of film studies. And continue to have, I guess, a really significant influence. So giving our attention in a singular and sustained way, whether at a cinema or elsewhere, shifts us out of the ways in which we normally experience and interact in contemporary life. And I think that changes as I said, not for everybody and not in every instance, but it really changes where film sits in that bigger media landscape. So I guess what really gets me enthusiastic about phenomenology is that it creates opportunities to think about the distinctive properties of cinema and of film viewing in a way that transcends some of the historically subjective judgments about cultural value and artistic merit. And so while not disagreeing with some of the fundamentals of these claims, I never thought I would come to agree with John Ellis about anything, but I kind of do. Phenomenology just demonstrates that there might be a more rigorous basis for making some of these claims and conclusions. So thank you very much for listening.
Well, that was fantastic. Thank you, Karina. Thanks very much for presenting for us. Really appreciate it. So I just had a couple of kind of questions to start, and then I'd like to throw it open for other people to ask questions as well. But I was wondering if you had any ideas about the way in which these different modalities, like outside of the traditional theatre experience, how they might maybe kind of split up and create this kind of newer form of cinema. I'm thinking kind of about like the ideas of post-cinema put forward by Denson and later about like introducing different ways of conceiving of creating cinema rather than creating it for that sort of environment, creating it for these different modalities. I was wondering if you thought, if you had any thoughts on that about this kind of reconception of the actual product of cinema.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I guess audio visual screen production has expanded hugely, and I don't, so that idea of post-cinema is a very interesting one, and I think is one that will continue to develop outside of kind of, I guess, products made for the cinema or with the idea of a cinema type of audience. The sort of the contrast to that at the minute seems to be YouTube and other types of kind of screen content audiovisual in nature, but tend to be short form. The idea seems to be that to capture or sustain the interest of an audience outside of that cinematic context, whether that's actually in a cinema or somewhere else, seems to be that it needs to be short, brief, pithy, that kind of thing. So I don't know that we're quite at the point yet where we've got to post-cinema.
Yeah.
Although I'm not say that wouldn't eventually happen.
Yeah, but that idea of that you can sustain the sort of interaction or immersion engagement of a cinema type thing outside of that environment.
Yeah.
It's very interesting.
And I think, you know, devices play a role in that as well. So what you might want to, say, watch on your phone, you're quite happy to watch a two-minute video. You don't necessarily want to watch a film or a feature or, say, an episode of a television series unless you had some other option, I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting. At the SSWANZ conference, there was the idea brought up in one of the talks, one of the seminar talks, about cinemas, I think it was in Japan. Do you remember this conversation where they were introducing multi-screen, or did you bring this up before?
Yeah, we were talking about in the break, yeah. But was it in China?
Yeah,
they
China.
They have the comments at the bottom of the screen in the...
Yeah, so this idea that in China they're doing like a cinema experience where you can take your tablet and take your phone and you can kind of comment and interact. You know, you've got an interactive sort of screen experience while you're actually watching the film. And I was wondering what your thoughts are on that and how you can sort of see that necessarily kind of tying into your research project.
Well, I guess in some ways it's an extension of perhaps what you do already as an audience member when you're at a film. Is, say, talk to the person next to you if something particularly, you know, grabs you about the film, or someone does something stupid, or, you know, you might say to the person, you know, make a comment to the person next to you. But, of course, we don't just have interpersonal interactions. We spread it all over the internet when we have an idea about anything these days. So I guess that's kinds of expands that. And also, I was saying to Phoebe, I guess it's got to do with mobile phone culture as well, and that idea that people don't necessarily want to switch them off.
Yeah, we were aghast when the idea got brought up, and then Deb, who I think was leading the talk, Deb Beethoven was leading the talk, was like, no, if this is what the audience demands, then this is what we should give the audience. Mm. Like, this is what people want, if they want that experience. But it does, it raises interesting questions about that kind of, that breaking of phenomenological entanglement with the, like, how you can establish that idea of getting so engaged and immersed with the properties of the screen when you're moving between two different interfaces.
Yeah, and I guess that in a way that distracting sounds like that's a bit of a value judgment on that, which I don't necessarily mean it in that way, but it is dividing your attention up. So perhaps it does ultimately create a different kind of experience.
Mm. Interesting. Another question I had that sort of was brought up about this idea you're talking about, yeah, about having kind of the tactile engagement of traditionally kind of like tablets or screens in like a mobile phone form, and whether or not you thought that as per Richardson, that idea of from Merleau-Ponty of tools becoming something that we get techno-somatically involved with, so to the point where they become kind of perceptually engaged with our bodily experience, how you see that perhaps maybe mediating some of these issues of not necessarily being really connected, not being as immersed as in a theatrical experience? Like, does this sort of mediate some of those?
Yeah, it does to some extent. Although I think, you know, Richardson, one of the things that she talks about is that while that's possible, that say when you're using a tablet or a phone, you don't tend to stay fixed in one task. So even though you can sort of become immersed, I suppose, and perhaps not conscious, as that's sort of what Merleau-Ponty's talking about, is that those actions become things you're no longer thinking about, and you kind of, that technology becomes one with you, is that you're shifting all the time. So Richardson's talking about how you don't stay doing the one thing all the time. You might watch something on YouTube, then check your emails, then go back to Facebook, then go back. And so this process of shifting your attention to something else is sort of part of this, reinforcing her idea anyway, of this thing of being in front of you rather than...
Which works against that sort of concept of the kind of institutionalized immobility of sitting in the theatre seat and being kind of contained to be directed, you know, like going back to sort of, you know, apparatus theory, you know, being sort of forced to experience that world. Yeah.
Which kind of is a very regimented kind of way. I mean, I think about reading that kind of stuff, those arguments, as being, yeah, very limiting and some way of watching cinema. But in a way, that's almost liberating now, the way in which we're always, you know, on screens, touching stuff. The sitting still and just watching one thing is almost like a relaxation in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, it's true.
So, I don't
know. It's because it is the different experience now to do that. Yeah. The other question, the last question I sort of had before opening up was, I was wondering if you'd like to tell us a little bit more about the research project that you've put forward and what that study would involve.
It's to do an audience research project on a large-ish scale. And to do it, so it is concerned with looking at film consumption, and so it's an ethnographic project, so it involves doing focus groups with audiences. Then doing commissioning a large survey, so that would be largely statistically based, but with some sort of open-ended questions, and then following that up with some household case studies, which I'd like to do over a period of 12 months. This is in my ideal world when I get this big grant. But so a lot of audience research is, because it's just so intense as a type of research method, and very costly. You can only often do it on a fairly small scale, and very often you've only got a chance to talk to audiences once. So when I was doing my research on rural cinema going, you know, I only ever met people normally once, the audience members, you know, when I got to interview them or so on. So the idea with doing something, you know, a study of, say, a household, because that's a, I guess, a discrete unit, or collection of people, not necessarily all families or anything like that, but that you can go back over that period of time several times to talk to them, ask them to keep a diary record of when they're watching films and what they're doing. And, you know, it's hard.
Yep.
And it's tricky to keep the household motivated to continue for 12 months with what you're doing. And, you know, so there's, it's not necessarily easy. But the idea, I think, of being able to track people over a sort of a longer period is something that most people don't get the opportunity to do in audience research very much.
Yeah. I was curious how you would address that issue of, and I don't know, I'm making an assumption that you are, so you can probably let me know, of how an audience can kind of reframe their own understanding of their experience from, in terms of phenomenological perspective, the kind of the howness of how they're experiencing this media is something that most people, it's a habitualized thing that we kind of, we don't really pay attention until you. So is that, you're trying to get to a little bit of that and try to reframe, get them to kind of reframe their experience?
No. I want them just to tell me about what they're doing.
Yeah.
And I do the reframing.
Okay.
Yeah. I think, because I think that's a really tricky aspect for doing audience research. And I think to do it successfully, you do need to not overcomplicate it for people. And I think, you know, I've especially found that when I did my rural cinema research, you know, people didn't want to hear me talking about what I was doing in my research and all the big ideas I had.
Yep.
They were from, you know, Bingara Cinema, you know, 800 miles from Sydney, and they just wanted to tell me about the films I was screening and what they were doing. And that really was what I needed to know. I needed to know that, and then I needed to kind of analyse and think about, you know, what that all meant.
Yeah.
I think that it's collecting their perspective.
Yeah, collecting their perspective and being able to deduce that from what they're telling
which
you.
Which is a kind of, you know, obviously a very subjective thing that you're doing. But to me, I think that's the way audience research will works better.
Does anyone have any questions?
Have you died yet, waiting for to ask your question? Or have you forgotten?
Yeah. No, I just, when you were talking about the Chinese, the audiences texting on the screen, I think that's really interesting. But I also think it's worth maybe acknowledging, like, cultural differences, because I got reminded of, like, in India, where they had these, like, three-hour Bollywood films where people are, like, shouting that throughout the film. Mm-hmm. So I think with the Chinese thing, like, obviously China and India are not the same country, but they are Eastern cultures, and I think in the Western cultures, it's still, like, it's so ingrained that we shut up during a movie, and that if you have your phone, like, turned up in terms of the illumination, like, you are disturbing the people around you, and, like, I think it'd be really interesting if that was ever introduced, but I just kind of don't see it, in a way, at least not happening in the near future.
Mm.
But what I was going to say, based on your original talk, this is not really a question, it's just kind of anecdotal evidence that might be relevant to you. I don't know if I would argue anymore that being in a cinema is more, like, immersive, because if you get to a movie when it says it's going to start, you have to sit through half an hour of ads and previews, and most movies today, even if they're, like, blockbuster movies, they're, like, 2.5 hours long. So I really struggle to sit through 3 hours of a movie in a cinema without the ability to stop it, and you know, like, without the control. Like, unless I'm watching, like, On the Waterfront or Cool Hand Luke or something, I get annoyed in the cinema, and I much prefer to watch films on my own where I can stop it after 40 minutes and maybe even do something else and come back to it. And, like, I did grow up going to the cinema, but now it could be a product of the type of movies that are coming out that I just don't really enjoy the cinema experience anymore.
Isn't that related to research about when they say mobile phones are shortening our
attention spans and all
that? It may not be you're enjoying it or not enjoying it, it's to do with your...
But I think the key observation you're making is it's not necessarily changing your immersive qualities of what you're watching. You're just doing it in shorter durations.
Well, it's detracting from it because I'm frustrated at the fact that I have to sit there for so long. And if a movie's not blowing my socks off, then I start thinking about other things.
Well, films have got longer since digital cinema has come in. You know, they did. I've read various articles about their how they've increased, and to the point where, for a rural cinema, that you know, if you've only got one or two screens, once upon a time maybe you could program five sessions a day. Now you can only do four because the films are too long, and you just can't physically fit them in. And they're all quite cross because that means, you know, less ticket sales, less popcorn, less everything. But it's fine if you've got 20 screens.
It's 20% movie.
20% less revenue.
I mean, I don't want to be like the old man yelling at cloud, but when I was growing up, like, movies like Goodfellas were 2.5 hours long, but now Transformers 2 is 2.5 hours long. Like, do we need an epic film about fighting robots? Like,
I don't know. I hope Lego Batman is 2.5 hours long.
Well, I expect it will be.
I hope it is.
One of my colleagues at West Sydney said that he now watches every movie in two parts.
I do too.
He turns every movie into like it has like a sequel.
I do that too.
Yeah.
I very rarely watch a movie from start to finish.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, yeah,
and
I seem to remember Mum telling me that she doesn't like there were long films. You know, if you think about like Cleopatra or Ben Hur or Gone with the Wind or
Godfather.
Even what was I watching the other night that was 3 hours? Some Like It Hot with Marilyn Monroe. It was like 3 hours and I was like, God, this is... But Mum telling me when she worked in the cinema there was quite often an interval, right, where you went and had...
So that's
more like being in a... I was struck by what you were saying is that going to the cinema is almost like this meditative state now where you are unable to do anything. And I think that you still get that in, like, theatre.
Because there's intermissions in the theatre.
Like, you really cannot look at your phone in a play. You really can't. I don't know where that was going. It's just an observation.
So I'm not really a film student or anything, but in regards to immersion with film, I do agree, or I feel that it is somewhat meditative, because I prefer watching films at, say, like 10 a.m. on a Friday when no one's going to be there. I can just have a coffee, be in a new cinema, and just immerse myself in this film. Or likewise, I have a personal, like a home projector that I just like project on my wall on the cinema beanbag and just watch a movie like I did yesterday. But I think one of the things that may play into that want for that immersion in, say, theater or film versus like personal device is that, take for example going to the movies. For I guess your just assumption, but your average cinema goer, whenever, like I live in Sydenham for example, so my two nearest theaters are Dendy and Broadway. If everyone's ever been in Dendy, it's always like a massive freaking backed up line, regardless if they're showing like, I don't know, the history of the English dictionary. Like, it's just, it's ridiculous. And to go through that traffic down King Street just to go to Broadway, like, if you ever tried parking in Broadway, parking any day, like, you just can't. So to plan that experience, not only do you have to plan a certain day, you have to kind of like plan out, you know, how far from the release you want to go to not be crammed in a cinema, to the people you might want to go with, to their availabilities, to, and it's not just you show up there and start watching right away, like, you have to show up a bit before, try the parking, then since you have that time to kill, then you're like, okay, I gotta get some food before, do something leading up to this. I mean, it's just, it's not a simple thing anymore, like, you have to, like, you know.
But if you were given the same experience that you could, you know, somebody says, here's a tablet, and you could sit and watch this at home right now, you don't have to go through any of that. You might still make the choice to negotiate all the rest of the stuff that goes with it in order to have that particular.
Yeah, I would agree, but it depends on, I think it comes down to personal preference on, like, what you're viewing, I guess, biases. Like, there's certain, you know, horror film that you absolutely love, whereas, like, I do, you prefer, at least for me, you prefer a bigger screen to sort of immerse yourself in. You can't watch, like a film on a tablet. I mean, maybe I can watch Transformers on a tablet, but something I actually want to watch. Like, it's nice to kind of have a meditative immersion into it. But that varies, I suppose.
Mm.
I thought of my question.
Yeah.
Sorry. Because you were talking about immersion, and I kind of wanted to ask both you and Adam this, because Adam is studying virtual reality and cinema. So to me, when I think of immersion, I would think virtual reality cinema is that immersion. So I suppose I wanted to ask both of you, because you had, when you brought those VR headsets in for us, that was a real bodily sort of experience for me, and particularly because Adam is doing horror has this real kind of body response. So I just wanted to, yeah, perhaps ask your opinion on what your thoughts on virtual reality cinema is and that immersion. And also, I mean, we've got up here, like, people with 3D glasses, you know, like, all those sort of gimmicky things that are added to how that factors into your research.
Well, 3D's kind of been a bit of a fizzer. And, you know, part of it is, you know, people say they don't like wearing their glasses. Mm.
Particularly if you wear glasses, it's really bad. Yeah.
So I guess with virtual reality, even though you're immersed in something, you still have to kind of get over that awareness of your body and awareness of perhaps, you know, wearing the device and that kind of stuff. But, yeah, I mean, it creates a very, I guess, kind of, I don't know, I think this condition of being within, and the term I was using was absorption, which I think is different to immersion. I think that what VR is sort of doing is a sort of, you know, the next step or a step beyond.
Yeah, well, it's a forced immersion because you are, phenomenologically, you are kind of put in that position of the space.
Yeah.
But, I mean, this is one, like, this is kind of part of what I'm writing about at the moment, is this idea of that absorption is the element now that they're trying to really find ways of how do you return these kind of experiences to that kind of, like you said, when you're watching something on a plane, on a tiny screen, and you're totally absorbed with it. Quite often the immersive properties of virtual reality are so strong that it kind of negates that ability to be absorbed in the way that, like, subject would posit in the Dress of the Eye, but where you become part of the consciousness of that film.
Yeah.
Phenomenologically, yeah. So it's interesting.
Yeah. And I think another aspect to it that's interesting is that immersion is coming from the eye. It isn't actually being physically experienced, although your body is being engaged in a way that it isn't possibly with standard.
I was talking to Karina before we started talking, and I'm saying I actually think there's, in a weird way, kind of heightens, it's a different type of embodiment, but it heightens your embodiment because it can be so disjunctive from your real. So I was telling her about this VR project I was looking at the other day where you're strapped down to a chair and some killer robot's trying to kill you. And it's weird because you're in a female body as a male, which is really weird and disjunctive. And you strap down to a chair and you're also sitting. So you've got that, you've got the kind of equivalency of the sitting and stuff, but you've also got the weird thing of, like, you look down and you're in a female body as a male, you know, like all of these ideas of, like, gender gaze and stuff. It's quite strange.
Yeah. Are you a good looking woman?
Yeah.
You are.
At least
we are.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
That does change things slightly.
And that's something that you not experience as a male viewer when you're absorbed, if we're talking between absorption and immersion, that happens when you're watching a horror film and it takes on the point of view of, I mean, it's always the girl that gets killed, right?
Yeah.
Like, she's one of the first characters to go. So when there's a sort of point of view shot.
Or the last character to survive.
Or the final girl.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't have that experience, so.
Yeah, it's like that a full extension of that masochistic of wanting to be in the position of that final girl to the point where you're actually literally in the position of the final girl. So.
But don't you think that would be slightly disassociating? That would be slightly interrupting immersion, I think. If you were in a game and you're a guy and then suddenly you've got a body of a hot girl, what are you thinking? You're not...
Definitely.
I think you're not thinking about being immersed.
No, that's right. But it also has the other thing, like, and looking at how it moves through different... looking at the way in which they move through different cuts, that part of it's really challenging. Like, that's one of the things I'm looking at the moment, people who are experimenting with using traditional, conventional cinema cuts in a VR experience. So you get kind of perceptually established, and then all of a sudden the scene cuts and you're like, where have I gone? I was here and now where am I? So there's even that element which is really jarring. So it's not even just like placing you, like you said, like in a game where it positions you in a particular body, but does anyone else have any questions?
Well, speaking about elements that jar immersion, I wonder if either or both of you have thoughts on the trend in a lot of Eastern cinemas actually now, in which they're turning more into like a roller coaster ride almost. Like the chairs themselves have motors, the shape, you're sprayed with water throughout the films. They have air conditioners and fans that actually blow that blow air onto you as appropriate throughout the film. That
4D.
Yeah.
I think that's the big calling.
Would that lead into this conversation? Is that disjunctive, or would that be something that would increase immersion?
I don't know. My only experience of 4D cinema is at Legoland in Windsor. It was a Lego Chima. I don't know how many of you have got kids, but
what does that involve?
If you had a boy, you would know what Lego Chima is. But it's just a old beast, lion, crocodiles, wolves and things, this whole set of Lego. Anyhow, but they had a battle, and so that had the same thing, the water spraying up on you, some little explosion-type firework kind of things. But I found it more sort of distracting than anything because you were looking, perhaps it was a novelty as well. Where did that come from, or what would be the next thing, that you would experience them?
Yeah, I would think that too. I actually haven't done the 4D thing, although I saw more cinemas in the States when I was last over there that had been like, that were now offering a 4D experience as part of their, typically, action movies or whatever that fits into that kind of category. Yeah.
So someone falling off a cliff and then something be windy or something.
Yeah, that's right.
So kind of generic effects that they can apply to...
Even like an explosion goes off and there's heat, you get a sense of heat because they just blow heat at your face and stuff like that. Yeah.
And how about other tickets? Are a lot more expensive?
Yeah, are they like $25 to $30 a ticket? So
for that reason, I imagine it's going to go the way of 3D, which is a short
limit. Yeah. That people don't do once. You do it once and you go, I've done that now, so yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anybody else? No. Well, I think we might wrap up there. Can we all give Karina a...
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Sydney Screen Studies Network Talks. Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. You can follow us on Twitter @_SSSnetwork, like us on Facebook @Sydney Screen Studies, and visit us at sydneyscreenstudies.wordpress.com.